How do we know those are true? Do we stop? Do we inquire? Munindra, when they had the car accident, he ended up at my house during the time that I swore if any more spiritual people came near me, I was going to punch their lights out. Because I had hit that point in practice where I saw my mind, I saw the work to be done, and I just wanted to, you know, there's that, what's that movie, The Matrix, where, you know, the guy is lamenting. He said, I just want to have a lot of sex and eat a bunch of steak, you know. I don't want to do this. I don't want to. I was 20-something years old. It was just like, oh, man. And then here he came. He's walking around my house. Oh, you live in a beautiful jungle, Jenny. And it's just like, wow, okay, I'm going to be nice to him. And then I started listening to him, and then my heart opened again to my practice. Because he started teaching me how to do the most ordinary things, wash my own dishes with wakefulness. And he started harassing my husband, and I loved that. It was wonderful. And then after he'd been there 4 days, he said, you have Buddhists here. I will answer their questions. Well, I didn't know anybody. I put my name as a sitting group in the Inquiring Mind, which is the journal of this particular tradition, and nobody had called me ever, not a single person. And if they had, I would have been terrified. And so I knew only one thing to do. I called the local community radio station and made an announcement. You know, at 7 o'clock on a certain evening at my house, here's the address. There's this Buddhist teacher, and, you know, he had a reputation and a name for himself. People knew of him because he had been Ram Dass's teacher, so people knew that, and this group of people, kind of, my mind, you know, we were talking about that aspect of judgment for strangers that one comes to, you know, and then learning to oppose it through that equanimity practice is beautiful. But when this group of people showed up at my house, my mind said, whoa, this is a motley crew. Because it just seemed like, you know, 4 or 5 people that I'd never seen in my life. But among them was this probably 16-year-old young man who was just like this. He was so excited, and he couldn't wait to get in, and he had this book under his arm. And he came right in, and I had this kind of couch at the time that kind of went around a corner. And Munindra sat on part of it, and he sat right next to him, even though there's this huge expanse. Butt to butt, they're right there. He's like, I'm on you. You're not getting away from me. And so Munindra, you know, everybody else sat down. We're all kind of there. And there's this uneasy silence in the group, and Munindra said, if you have questions concerning meditation practice, please tell me now. And this young man said, I do. He said, you see, and this is what is so amazing about unsatisfactoriness. We think that it is such an assumption in the world that we don't question it one bit. And so this young man spoke from right within his. And, you know, in all my practice, I don't think I've ever gotten a more powerful gift than I got from that young man. Being so open and out there and just laying it out without any kind of concern for his ego. He knew what he wanted. He didn't know how to ask the question. And you know what? That does not matter. It's the openness that asks the question. It's the openness that opens the door. The words don't do it. So he said, I am having a miserable life. But I looked at him. I'm in training to be a psychologist. I'm supposed to check his body language, do all that, you know. So I'm there, I'm doing that. And he was going, I'm having a miserable life. Joie de vivre coming through every pore. Just this, this delight, this youth, energy coming through. He said, and so I've brought this book, written by Carlos Castaneda. He says it's possible to leave the body. And I know that you know how to do these things. And so I want you to teach me. Well, the energy in the room completely shifted. Because have you ever been around a spiritual teacher that you thought might know that stuff? But you didn't want to ask that question because it was like, oh, no, I'm not going there. Here was our Savior, the 16-year-old kid who just let it all hang out. And everybody went. It's like, yes. And Munindra said, you want to leave the body? Said, yes, I'm not happy. I mean, I just, and Carlos Castaneda says, and he says, first of all, if you're not happy in the body, you're not happy out of the body. See, we know the truth. We know these things, don't we? It's so interesting that the mind thinks it'll get you in a corner, it'll paint you in a corner in like 3 in the morning now or whatever, and you think, oh my gosh, da-da-da-da, whatever it is. If only, you know, if only I would just get out of this somehow. Maybe, you know, the Buddha said there were 3 kinds of craving, and our minds take us to all 3. There's craving for non-existence. I want out. I don't want this to end, which is what this young man was suffering from. Craving for existence. When you think you're not going to exist, then you turn around and crave for existence. And then the third is just craving for getting what you want when you want it, sense pleasure, that kind of thing. But what he had to say next was wonderful. He said, he patted him on his leg, on his knee, and he said about Carlos Castaneda, I know of this man. He is not happy either. He said, please. And, you know, I wonder, because it's a real talent to work with beginners in this practice, because we're selling water by the river. It's the biggest snake oil scam in the history of the universe. Because what we are teaching is so subtle and so quiet that it is masquerading behind this sense of self. It's hiding behind this sense of I, me, and mine. And it keeps coming up and saying, you know, if you could just finally get all these conditions met, then you're going to be happy. So just keep slogging, keep slogging. And yet when we observe, we see that's not how things work. You know, that's taking out your cobbler's kit and trying to cover the entire world with shoe leather. That's taking out your Carlos Castaneda book and trying to get out and fly, because that would really be fun and cool. So Munindra patted him. He said, "Dear one, I save you many steps if you can hear me now." It's like, this is it. I'm getting back in my car. I'm going to California. But I offer you this offering. He said, if you can hear me now, be ordinary person. Live your life fully. Want to know where they got the title from? That. Live your life fully. Said, yes, you can do these things. You can do these things. You can get lost in meditative powers, go round and round and round and round, caught in power, but it is still not satisfying at the core. He said, please hear me. Be ordinary person. Notice your life. Live it as it is being lived. Cook breakfast with all your attention. Do your work with all your love and attention. Learn to practice meditation and give this gift to your family. This gift of learning the way of peace. So I don't know what happened to that young man. I have no clue. I do know that he settled. He heard to a certain degree, as far as one can tell. He seemed to get what Munindra was talking about. But I do know what happened for me, because it put me back on my path. It put me back in a practice, even though I had to do it completely alone, no teachers, no communication at that time with teachers. Internet hadn't happened, and teachers were rare as hen's teeth, and it was hard to find them. But still, you know, I had spiritual friends. We shared books. We shared practices with each other. And the dedications, what I heard in that evening, has been with me ever since. So this is, I'm on a Kabir kick in this retreat. This is from Kabir. Again, Persian mystic poet. He says, friend, hope for the guest while you are alive. You know, these when reading these poems from other wisdom traditions, I feel it's incumbent upon me to translate the way that things are described. The guest is like coming into the unconditioned, coming into this place of living in peace and freedom beyond the desperate and tight little parameters of the conditioned mind. So friend, hope for the guest while you are alive. Jump into experience while you are alive. What you call salvation belongs to the time before death. If you don't break your ropes while you are alive, do you think the ghosts will do it after? The idea that the soul will join with the ecstatic just because the body is rotten, that's all fantasy. What's found now is found then. If you find nothing now, you will end up in an apartment in the city of death. If you make love with truth now, in the next life, you will have the face of satisfied desire. So plunge into the truth. Takes tremendous courage, dear friends, to do that, because we all have listened to each other. We listen to each other in the small groups talking about, or even the song by the country and western singer about how our minds have a mind of their own and how they get us into all these predicaments, all these spots. But the tremendous courage is not to hate that experience, but to open to it with presence and begin to wear through the veil of belief, notion, what Wendell Berry again calls this constant forethought of grief, to wear through it. So plunge into the truth. Find out who the teacher is. Now that's a good one. Guess who that is? I'm going to give you the cliff notes. Do you know who your teacher is? Yeah. You're sitting in them. Kabir says this, when the guest is being searched for, it is the intensity of the longing that does all the work. Look at me and you will see a slave of that intensity. So becoming a devotional lover of truth, just like the parrot, that parrot story of having that quality of intention and yet knowing that there is a quality of steadiness being asked of us. So people would ask Manindra, they'd say, you know, how do I practice? And he was one of those people who said, he would get up, and there's a teacher in this tradition who was his number one student for many years. His name is Joseph Goldstein. And Manindra would watch Joseph teach a retreat, you know, the sort of standard teacher up at the front. And he'd say, oh, Joseph, why are you mollycoddling them? Just teach the practice and leave them on their own. Then when they go home, they will still practice. Who knows? But when people would press him, he would say, just be simple and easy. Just rest in awareness. So let's talk about that. Here's this bell. So you're sitting here, and a thought comes up inside this container of the bell, this sort of witnessing presence. And you're going, oh, there's thinking. But then the thought goes, but I'm a really amazing thought, and I'm going to scare the hell out of you. Listen to this. You blah, 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 blah. And all of a sudden, here you go. You go, bing, 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 bing. Just be simple and easy. Rest in awareness. Okay. Back. Back witnessing this experience from this spacious quality that can hold it, not one that's in there churning out more thoughts to help it pull us into the practice. Well, I called it a manufacturing plant for suffering. You know? So Manindra would teach people out in the world. I've told this story 1,000 times, but here it comes again. Um, we drove him around, and then this other gentleman showed up to take him somewhere, and Munindraji said to the gentleman, "No, no, we have to go and get Jenny. I want Jenny to come along with us." And this man was not happy. He wanted to have the teacher all to himself, and so he kept kind of sending, I was in the back seat of the car, and he would send these kind of passive-aggressive barbs out every so often. And it was going on and going on. And, you know, if you've ever been in a situation like that, it's not pleasant. It's not an easy situation. And so at one point, at first, you know, I'm just saying, that's what he's doing. It's fine. He'll get over it. But then when I saw he wasn't going to get over it, and he sort of upped the ante and got more and more rude as time went on, I just went right up, here, you know, here it is, up in my head, and I'm going, oh, you know, what a jerk, what an idiot, blah, blah, in my mind, just all this stuff. And all of a sudden, Munindra turned around. He was in the front seat. I'm in the back seat. He turned around. He said, "Jenny, what are you thinking?" And it's a perfect moment because I didn't even know what I was thinking. I was in that state of suffering. And so I stopped and centered. I saw what was happening. And he could tell that I was going to answer, which would have been really difficult. I was sitting there thinking, how do I answer this question? He said, "No, no, don't answer." He said, "Just know this. If thoughts of suffering are happening in your mind, they are not happening in anybody else's mind, only yours." Bam. Whoa. It's like, wait a minute. What just happened? This is from Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Practicing the Power of Now. He says, "All inner resistance is experienced as negativity in one form or another. All negativity is resistance. In this context, the two words are almost synonymous. Negativity ranges from irritation or impatience to fierce anger, from a depressed mood or sullen resentment to suicidal despair. Sometimes the resistance triggers the emotional pain body, in which case even a minor situation may produce intense negativity, such as anger, depression, or deep grief." Now here is what was revealed to me in that moment. The ego believes that through negativity it can manipulate reality and get what it wants. It believes that through it, it can attract a desirable condition or dissolve an undesirable one. So if I just sat in the back seat and hated that guy enough for his rudeness, it would make him, it would show him. And the Buddha likens that to holding a hot coal in your hand. You know, that's what it's like. Eckhart Tolle goes on, "If you, the mind, did not believe that unhappiness works, why would you create it? The fact is, of course, that negativity does not work. Instead of attracting a desirable condition, it stops it from arising. Instead of dissolving an undesirable one, it keeps it in place. So it creates this steady state of holding on for dear life to our own practice of suffering. Its only useful function is that it strengthens the ego, and that's why the ego loves it. So, in our practices, we begin to recognize the states of mind that come to us that continually create suffering. We start to awaken to them. In this tradition, the Buddha identified 5 different generalized states of mind and heart that when they come into this meditative container, really the first line of awakening is simply to know what's here. What's here? Is it anger? You know? Is it... Is it desire, wishing otherwise, wishing that things were different than they are? That's one of the habits of mind that comes, that we're taught, we've been conditioned to absolutely believe unequivocally because we're trying to better ourselves or we're trying to help or we're trying to fix. So sense desire for something comes, and instead of noticing that's what it is, often we get lost in it. So the Buddha said, hold it. Here are these 5 common experiences. Sense desire, anger or ill will, restlessness, drowsiness, or it's often called sloth and torpor. I love that. And the 5th is doubt. So when there's craving, we want something to be different. When we're undergoing this mental training, all we have to do is start to know what's occurring. Start to recognize, oh, here's desire. Here's wishing otherwise. And then to become investigative about that process. The first line of awakening is simply to recognize it. Anger or ill will comes in, destroying our calm. Actually, there was a discourse that was taught by the Buddha in which he used, it was this, like a simile of a lake, and you get in your boat and you row out and you're looking for the treasure at the bottom of the lake, which is peace and freedom, and you row out and you come into this part of the lake that's been tinted this certain color. You know, and that's, if you've ever been to Disney World, the perfect blue water that comes out of these things. And so you can't see through this tinting of desire, this urge for things to fit one's conceptual notions of how they should be. So then you row to another part of the lake, and there's this kind of churning thing going on, ill will. The antidote to anger, to ill will, irritation, annoyance, first, of course, is simple recognition. But if it persists as an experience, the antidote is loving kindness, compassionate, joy. So to actually apply the practice of loving kindness when anger keeps coming up and coming up. The next, restlessness, called flurry, worry. When worry comes into the mind, it's an incredibly powerful experience, pulling us up. So each time we bring the attention back and just know this experience, we're waking up out of it. But it's like we've gone to this part of the lake where white caps are everywhere, you know, just popping up, and there can't be any settling. So to awaken to this quality, and sometimes working with restlessness, a wonderful thing to do is to actually increase your focus to become more interested in the object. What is the experience of restlessness? What's going on in the body? What do you notice? What is present? To really begin this process of pushing into these states and holding them in view. And if the attention gets pulled off into the worry again, to recenter and re-notice, ah, this is what restlessness is like. Another way is to make the focus really wide, so create this large meditative focus and allow the restlessness to exist within that. The next is called drowsiness, and we all work with this. The Buddha said that, or the Buddha taught that you could pull your ears, and there are all these jokes about Buddha statues having long earlobes, because sometimes when you find yourself sleepy and drowsy, what comes up is what you want to do is create more energy. You can open your eyes. You can stand to practice meditation. Christy talked about that the first night. Another aspect to drowsiness, sometimes when things are difficult, when things are heavy and in our hearts, or we're asked to stay present, or things are coming up for us that are difficult to stay present for, what can happen is that we become drowsy, secondary to that experience. Once in my workplace, once I had a patient who was burned over 80% of his body, and every afternoon at 4:30, I would get my purse and I would go down to the burn intensive care unit, and I would put my purse in a locker, and I would do a whole big scrub, put on an isolation gown, mask, the whole thing, and go in to visit him. And then after I was finished, I would go home. And it was the smells, the sights, the sounds of that experience created that kind of dissociative reaction in me. And one day after I had left, I got in my car, I drove home, I walked in my house, and my husband looked at me and he said, "What are you wearing?" And I had completely spaced out that I was still in full isolation garb. And so we know that state that wants to separate from difficulty. So to start to open to drowsiness, to become curious, what is the experience like of falling asleep? This is how we tune in this process of wakefulness. We do it through intention. We do it through repetitive, patient action of coming into knowing what is here. again and again. It takes tremendous courage. Another way to work with drowsiness, sleepiness, is to recognize when you're tired and put yourself to bed. We cannot push ourselves through when we are tired. It is not helpful for us. It is not helpful for our practice. So to know when we need to rest and to offer that gift, knowing that we can come back and practice again, fresh, open, right there. And then the final hindrance to this meditative experience, meditative wakefulness, is doubt. And the predominant kind of doubt is not so much the doubt in the teachings as the doubt in our own ability to fulfill them. So it's interesting. I sort of left behind the simile of the lake, but with sleepiness, sloth, and torpor, you come to this part of the lake where there's like scum all over the water, all this cloudiness in the water. And it's interesting that of the hindrances, doubt can be one of the most difficult, but one of the best antidotes is to ask questions. Find spiritual friends. Ask them how they work with doubt. Ask teachers the questions like the young man. You know, how do I leave my body? Ask the transparent questions that get the kind of answers that you're really seeking. So, again, working with hindrances, the first line of wakefulness is simply to know, oh, this is one of the hindrances. These are commonly, you know, this list has been delineated of these things that pull me away from this quality of wakefulness. And simply to come back and know, oh, here is anger. Here is doubt. Here is sleepiness. And become curious and interested and open and be simple and easy with.